Welcome to this retreat. Ajahn Brahm is not here, as you can see. He's giving a talk in Olamara this evening, and that's why I'm here in his place. So there won't be as many jokes as usual, but hopefully you get something out of this anyway. One of the things I want to talk about is just briefly about, obviously this is going to be a very introductory talk, very basic things, and not so much about meditation, but more about how to use the facilities here, use the time here in such a way to get maximum benefit out of these 9 days that you have here. So basically, how to perceive your situation, how to put your mind in such a space that you actually have a good time while you're here, so that you enjoy it, to come back in the future for more retreats again in the future. But last thing you want to do is to have a retreat which is such that you never ever want to come back again afterwards. And this happened to me actually quite a couple of years ago when I went to Singapore. I was staying with a man in Singapore, and he said to me, "Oh, you know, these retreats, I went to a retreat once, and it was so terrible. I felt so uptight and so tense and so bad. Never ever in my life am I ever going to go on a retreat again." And that is bad. That's not good. That's not how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be an enjoyable experience. So make sure that you enjoy this retreat that you have here. If you enjoy it, it means that you'll come back for more retreats in the future. It means that you're on a spiritual path where you can grow in spiritual qualities. You can become a better person, a purer person, have a better heart. And gradually, over the months, over the years, you see that there's a change happening inside of you. You become more pure. You become more happy, you become more peaceful. And that is the whole purpose of the Buddhist path, is to move away from suffering and move towards happiness. So what you have to be careful on a retreat like this, you are moving from an ordinary life where maybe you keep the 5 precepts, which is great, is wonderful. Anybody who is serious about Buddhism should of course keep the 5 precepts. But when you come to a situation like this, suddenly you are faced with the 8 precepts rather than the 5. And the 3 additional precepts and the 5th one, which is changed to becoming living a celibate lifestyle, means deal with whatever restraint you have in a wise way. So it doesn't feel like an oppression, but rather it becomes an aspect of that path. It becomes something which propels you along the path and empowers your meditation, empowers your practice while you're here. It's very important to do that. Otherwise, you get the wrong end of the stick, so to speak. Restraint often to people means like a sense of force on you. It means something that you use your willpower to be able to restrain yourself, able to stop yourself from doing all the things that you normally do. Whereas meditation is the exact opposite of using willpower. Meditation is about being at ease, being relaxed, about enjoying yourself. So you have to find this balance between restraint and ease. If the restraint is going to work, it has to be an easy restraint, where you enjoy yourself, where you have a good time. So the important point here, what I'm trying to make, is that you want to use the restraint in such a way that you feel happy, you feel good about yourself, and you don't get uptight, and you get to the point when you never want to go on a retreat again. That is what this is all about. So to give you some examples of what I'm talking about is the first thing, of course, the first kind of restraint that you have here, which you don't have in ordinary life at home, domestic life, is that you can't eat in the afternoon. You are you have to live on a nice breakfast and also a main meal, and there are some tea and some chocolate and things in the evening. But still, I know when you come from lay life and you use the big meal in the afternoon, it can be problematic for you. And there is a nice sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha talks to Lady Visakha. And this sutta is about how to practice the 8 precepts. In those days, the 8 precepts were always kept on the Uposatha days. The Uposatha days are the days of the full moon and the new moon. At the time of the Buddha, people would come to the monastery and they would then keep the 8 precepts. And Lady Visakha, whom probably many of you have heard about, she was the Buddha's probably main female disciple, and she One whole monastery was actually given to the Sangha by Lady Visakha. She was a very wealthy and she was also a very devout lay disciple of the Buddha. So she went to this Uposatha ceremony to keep the 8 precepts, and she asked the Buddha, well, how should I keep these 8 precepts in a good way? So it actually is powerful, it's fruitful, it's something which gives rise to lots of good karma, to peace, to happiness in the future. And the Buddha tells Lady Visakha, first of all, how you should not keep these 8 precepts. And what he says is that if you go to the monastery, and because you have to restrain yourself, you sit there all day thinking about all the nice food you're going to make for yourself tomorrow when the 8 precepts is finished, the kind of roast you're going to roast in the oven, the baked potatoes you're going to have, and a nice chocolate pudding for dessert. If that is how you spend the 8 facts of Uposatha, the 8 precepts, then it does not have great fruit and great results. It doesn't actually do very much for you at all. And this is the same thing here on retreat when you're here now. Try to avoid that mind which thinks about all those things in ordinary life that you would have liked to do if you hadn't been here, the movies you would have liked to see, and you know, the food you would want to eat, and all these kind of things. If you see your mind going in that direction, you know that you're leaning in the wrong direction. The restraint is not really working, because it's like an oppression for you. It is an oppression, and that's why the mind goes out into the world of sensuality and thinks about all these things, because you're not at ease with the restraint that the 8 precepts require. So be careful with that. And then the Buddha tells Lady Visakha how you should live on the 8 precepts. And what he says to her is that when you keep those 8 precepts, the first thing you should think is that the arahants in the world keep these 8 precepts all the time. They never, ever do not keep these 8 precepts. So think about that. So what that means is that when you are on this retreat, you are following the path, whatever arahants there are in the world, you are practicing just like them. Isn't that a wonderful thought to think that? You are doing just exactly what the arahants in the world do. And inspire you in that way. Say, wow, I am doing something noble, something beautiful, something pure, which only arahants can keep fully 100% all the time. And inspire yourself, lift yourself up, and then you find it much easier to keep these things when you find that kind of inspiration in your heart. And then the Buddha said to Lady Visakha that when you think like that, then the next thing you should do is you should develop loving kindness, also compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Develop that to the whole world, expansive, wide, broad, without any defilements of the mind, and purify yourself through developing the Brahma Viharas, the loving kindness in particular. And when you do that, then you're going the opposite way of sensuality, going the opposite way of anger and ill will, and you find that the mind becomes very pure and very beautiful. And then you are living on the 8 precepts, you are doing the Uposatha practice in a way which brings great fruit and great benefit. And that is the way to go about it. So this is something you can take for your inspiration on this retreat. Remember, this is what it's all about. It's about meditating, getting rid of defilements. So be careful when those defilements, those thoughts about the home life start to rise in the mind, then you know that something isn't quite right. So when you find that you have to restrain yourself, you can't eat in the afternoon, well, remember that on this retreat, you still have a fairly easy schedule. You have a nice breakfast, you have a good meal, and in the evening, you're allowed to have some tea and chocolate or whatever else they're serving. I'm not sure exactly what it is. Use those requisites. Don't be too strict on yourself. If you're too hard on yourself, you find that it might give rise to ill will, might give rise to all kinds of problems in your mind. So be careful not to be too hard on yourself. Use the requisites here that are available in such a way that you don't get too many thoughts which are either sensual or negative in a certain way. And what this is really all about, it's about the middle way, the middle path. I talked about this to the previous retreatants that were here, and I will say it again. The middle path is the path where the body disappears. Why does the body disappear when you practice the middle way? And the reason is because if you indulge too much in sensuality, what happens then is that the mind goes out to the body because the mind wants to find happiness in the five senses. So the mind goes out to those five senses because that's where you find happiness. If, on the other hand, you restrain yourself too much, you have pain, you feel a sense of displeasure, the body isn't at ease, you're not happy the way things are, then again, the mind has an interest in the body, because the mind wants to solve the problems of pain that you have in the body. That is why this is called the other extreme, where you pursue a practice of pain, and again, the mind has an interest in the body because of that pain is there. Because you want to get rid of that, you want to be happy, you don't want to be in pain. So the middle path is the path between these two extremes, where the mind is not interested in the body because there is pleasure to be found in the body, nor is it interested in the body because there is pain to be found there. The body is just at ease, just nice and peaceful. And when there's no interest in the body like that, it tends to disappear. And that is where meditation can happen, when the body disappears. So this is how you should think. Think to yourself, what do I need to do on this retreat? So the body is at ease, neither overindulged nor painful, but the beautiful middle way which goes between the two. Then you know that you're going in the right direction. And sometimes I think if you have any doubt as to where the right direction is, what is not neither overindulgence nor too much pain, then I prefer to err on the side of indulgence. Because if you indulge a little bit, it means that you might get a little bit slothful or maybe a little bit restless or something. But if you err on the side of restraint, it's easy to get irritated and fault-finding with the people around you. And that is a worse hindrance, as far as the Buddha is concerned, I should say, for meditation practice. So that is the first thing. Eat wisely while you're here. Don't force yourself into some kind of ascetic regime or anything like that. And the second thing where restraint comes in is, of course, the fact that while you're here, you don't have all the normal escape routes that you have in ordinary life. There is nothing, there's no newspaper you can grab, there's no TV you can look in, there's no fridge you can sort of open at any time, and all these kind of things. Most of the normal escape routes are cut off. And because of that, sometimes when you get a bit restless, or you feel a bit, maybe ill at ease, and you're not happy with the way things are going, sometimes you don't know what to do with yourself. So again, it's important to know what to do if you get into that situation where you feel ill at ease and things aren't going so well. Everybody's going to have those times on a 9-day meditation retreat when things are not going exactly how that you think they should be going. So use the property we have here. There's 145 acres of property here. There's also state forests around this area. So every now and again, just go for a walk and relax and take it easy. Look at the birds, look at the animals, look at nature out there. This is one of the beautiful things that you are allowed and you can do as a meditator, as a retreatant. And I reminded also the previous group of meditators here that this was actually one of the things that you can see, even the arahants at the time of the Buddha, they would enjoy nature and they would praise nature. And they would say things like, oh, look at these beautiful blue skies and the birds flying around and the beautiful trees and the cliffs. Basically, they were praising nature. And you see all these poems by these arahants. There's some very famous poems by Mahakasapa, one of the Buddha's most famous disciples, where he, verse after verse, is about the beauty of nature. So use that. This is one of the wonderful attractions that you are, that is allowable as a meditator. So use that. And I know that probably the vast majority of you here, you live in cities, and often city people love to come out in nature and see the bush. Lots of people do bush walking and all these kind of things. So this is a chance to do a little bit of that as well while you're here, particularly if you need a little bit of break from your meditation practice. that is the first thing to do if you feel not too well. Things aren't going exactly right. Then, of course, the second thing to do is to do a little bit of reading sometimes. I'm sure most of you have probably brought some books with you. The good things to read are spiritual guidance, the word of the Buddha, these sort of things, which both provide a little bit of distraction, but again, they point you in the right direction. It doesn't actually take you away from the path. It keeps you on the path, but at the same time, it provides a little bit of distraction for you. That, again, is a wonderful thing to do. And the last thing I would say, advise, is that if you, particularly in the first few days, if you feel a bit tired because you've had a busy life out there, it is natural for you to feel tired. I know some of you come from far away, from the UK or from Malaysia or many other places, Melbourne and Sydney or whatever. Take that time to, if you need to sleep a little bit extra, please do so. Don't look at what your neighbors do. This is not a competition. You're not trying to sort of beat the Joneses in any sense. Do what you have to do. Look at yourself. What do you require to make progress? Don't look at what everybody else does. Don't worry if other people get up at 4 and you only get up at 6. That's fine. You don't have to worry about other people. Look at yourself. And one of the most useful guides that I found in the Nikayas to make decisions like this, what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And this is a guide which you see in several suttas by the Buddha. He said that whatever choice you make in life, when you make the right choice is always the one when it leads to more wholesome states in you and less unwholesome states. The wrong choice is when there is an increase in unwholesome states and a decrease in wholesome states. So ask yourself while you're here, ask yourself, is your mind developing and moving in the right direction? Are you becoming more peaceful? Are you becoming more gentle? Are you becoming more happy and more at ease? If you are, you know it is going the right direction. So that is what you should be asking yourself. Look at yourself. Don't worry about everybody else. It doesn't matter what they are doing. This is your practice. This is your retreat. This is your holiday from the world outside. So use it in that sense, in that way. So that is just some basic introduction, some basic ideas on how not to stress yourself out, to use the restraint you have here in a wise way, rather than using it in a way which leads to uptightness and a sense of dis-ease. Make sure you feel at ease, you feel relaxed, you feel good about yourself, then you know that you're moving in the right direction. Now, another thing that I... One more thing I should say, actually, about this thing about being at ease and not restraining yourself. One type of restraint, which is very useful in this type of retreat, is being quiet and being very sensitive to the people around you. So try, if you can, not to talk too much, and not to chat too much. If you need to chat, then do it away from the rest of the group. You don't disturb so many people. And also remember that in this meditation hall here, try to keep it as quiet as you can. Be sensitive to the people around you. There are going to be people here who have good meditation. And if somebody has really nice meditation, you make too much noise and you disturb them. And that's not such a nice thing here. On the other hand, if you are quiet and sensitive to the people around you, and you help them sort of boost their meditation, it's like a gift that you're giving to the people on this retreat. And this is one of the ways I recommend you to look at this thing. Again, don't make being peaceful and quiet into something oppressive. Make it into something beautiful. Make it into a gift that you're giving to the retreatants around you. Think, I am going to give these retreatants quietness. I'm going to give them sensitivity and be kind and be peaceful around when they are here. And then when you do it that way, you turn the perception around. Instead of feeling a sense of oppression about these things, you feel a sense of giving of yourself, a sense of doing something for other people and also doing something for yourself at the same time. And then it becomes something beautiful and something nice to do. And so much of the Buddhist path is about this. It's about being skillful in how you perceive things and how you look at things. And if you are skillful in how you look at things, almost anything which is part of the Buddhist path can become something nice and beautiful rather than feel as some kind of oppressive voice for you. So look at it that way. Try to change your perception about these things. And it's amazing how that can actually improve your own practice at the same time. And when you find that you are quiet and people get along together and you are sensitive to others, then you get into a situation when the whole group, you have a sense of harmony together, where everybody is looking after each other, everybody is kind to each other. As it says in the sutras, you blend like milk and water, you look upon each other with kindly eyes, with eyes of affection. And when you have that sense of looking upon each other with eyes of affection, with kindness, then what happens is that you feel a sense of joy in your heart. And this is, the Buddha said, again, this is from the Anguttara Nikaya 3, he said that when you have that harmony, that you look upon each other with affection and kindly eyes, then that is a basis for meditation to take off. If you haven't got that harmony, it's going to destroy your chances to meditate. When you have a sense of harmony, you feel joy. When you feel a sense of joy, you get the rapture. The rapture is a sense when you meditate and you feel this kind of energy inside of you, this kind of joyous energy inside of you, this rapture which arises when meditation starts to take off. When that rapture comes, when you keep on practicing like that, and there comes a point when that all falls down and becomes tranquil. The body becomes tranquil, the mind becomes tranquil. This is a consequence of rapture. As you keep on practicing that rapture, as you keep on moving through the rapture, tranquility eventually arises. When the tranquility arises, then comes a sense of happiness, sukha, peaceful sense of happiness. And that peaceful sense of happiness then gives rise to samadhi. And this is one of the things that Ajahn Brahm will be emphasizing, I can assure you, on this retreat, is this attaining and getting some samadhi, some tranquility, some peace. And this sequence I just taught you just now, harmony, joy, rapture, tranquility, happiness, and samadhi, this is one of the foundational sequences that you find in the suttas again and again and again. It's one of those very important teachings that you find all over the place. So it is something very, very important. It shows you the path, how you get to these states of samadhi. And then beyond that, beyond the samadhi, you have the yathābhūta ñāṇadarśana, the seeing of things as they really are. And then beyond that, you have the stages of enlightenment and all that. That is the path that you're looking at. And harmony there is one of the foundational aspects of that path. So it is very, very important to put emphasis into that. Now, one way of emphasizing that harmony, and one thing that I recommend you to do, is do a little bit of metta practice every day. This is so important, because if you have that sense of metta in your heart, it's so much easier to be generous and kind to the people around you. Sometimes it becomes second nature when you have that. So maybe after you have heard a talk by Ajahn Brahm in the morning, or after the Q&A, you may feel inspired by a nice talk. You may have laughed a lot by having listened to Ajahn Brahm. You may feel good about yourself. And then that is often a good time to do a bit of metta. And often with that metta practice, I know many of you are obviously Ajahn Brahm disciples. So if you are an Ajahn Brahm disciple and you feel you have a good relationship with Ajahn Brahm, it's always powerful to do that metta to your teacher, because that is somebody who inspires you and you feel good about. So start off your metta meditation often with doing metta to Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm, may you be well, may you be happy. Because even Ajahn Brahm, even though he is probably the happiest person I have ever met in my entire life, and I have lived with him for 16 years, so I can say that with some authority, even though that is the case, he also sometimes has burdens and problems that he doesn't want. He also has his times when, you know, things don't go the way they should be going. And he has a very heavy workload as the abbot the Bodhinyana monastery and the spirits of the rest of the Buddha site and what not else he has to do. So even Ajahn Brahm sometimes has to do things, actually a lot of the time he has to do things that are not pleasant, not nice, sort out problems, all kind of things. So Ajahn Brahm, may you be happy, may you be well. And once you build, it doesn't have to be towards Ajahn Brahm, it can be towards whoever you take as your spiritual guide, or whoever you feel good about in this world. Build up that feeling of goodness inside of you, and then bring it out to all the retreatants on this retreat. In particular, those people that you don't know very well here, all those, I'm sure most of you don't have close relationships with everybody here. These are, remind yourself that these are beautiful people who come on retreats like this. These are all people who are here to purify themselves, here to do good things, here to enhance their own life and also help other people. People who are willing to sacrifice 10 days of their life just to meditate and produce something good and beautiful in the world. Now that is really, really worthy of respect. Remind yourself of that. And remind yourself of that because it is so easy to get irritated by small little things in life. It's absolutely bound to happen that people are going to do things here which you don't like. Because we are all different, we all have different ideas, we have different perceptions, different viewpoints of things. Because we have those different viewpoints and perceptions, bound to happen that somebody is going to do something that is not quite to your liking. 9 days together, 60 people like this, I can assure you it's going to happen. So build up this diet, this wall of resistance, of metta inside of you. So when you see something happening outside of you, you don't like it, you just shrug your shoulders and you are completely equanimous about it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't actually affect you anymore because you have this built up this power inside of you of metta towards all these people around you. And it is that beautiful intention of all these people who come here to do something good, positive. Focus on that intention. Focus on the fact that people are trying to do their best to do something positive and good. Now that is already a very beautiful thought and a good start to start off this meditation retreat. So do a little bit of that metta every day and then you will be able to enhance your experience of this meditation retreat many, many, many fold. So when once you have that barrier there, it makes life much easier. But sometimes, even if you have that barrier inside of your heart to block out the negative feelings, sometimes it still happens that negative feelings arise. Now, when that happens, it's good to have a few strategies to be able to deal with those negative feelings, because otherwise, again, it can destroy the happiness of a retreat like this. I'm going to give you a couple of strategies which I use myself in my own practice, because when you live in a monastery, it's a bit like coming on a retreat like this. You have the same people every day around you, and it's unavoidable that sometimes you get upset, not because the people around you are bad, but simply because of your own defilements usually. So one of the ways, and this is one of the ways that many people use in the world, is to remind yourself that you cannot change the world. The world is the way it is. And part of that world, which is the way it is, are all the people around you. People are what they are because of cause and conditions from the past. They have grown up in a certain way, they had certain parents, they've gone to school in a certain way, had certain teachers, they had past lives where they've been conditioned in a certain way. And because of all that, they have come to be the product that they are here and now. And remind yourself that this is just nature. All these people around you is just nature, the way they are. And when you remind yourself of that, you know that there's no point in getting angry, because you are not going to be able to change these things anyway. When you remember that, you take away, that is enough to take away some of that irritation of people around you. And this is the simile. I'm sure probably most of you have read Ajahn Brahm's book, Opening Doors of Your Heart. And this is the simile he has in that book about the red light. And I think the story goes something like this, that there's a man who is very busy and he's rushing and jumping into his car, going off to a meeting somewhere. And just as it goes around the first corner, there's a red light there. And he gets really upset with this red light because he needs a green light because he's busy. He has to get to this meeting. So he gets really upset and really angry with this red light and gets out of his car and shakes, gives this red light a good shaking so he can become green again. But of course, that is madness. That is crazy. Because a red light is just basically, it's a computer circuit which every now and again it becomes red. It stays red for a couple of minutes, it becomes green again. There's no point in getting angry with a red light. You have to resign yourself to the fact that this light has become red, and you happen to be the unfortunate victim of that happening. And the point is, of course, the deep teaching here is that people, the world, everything are just like lights. Every now and again, the people around you become red. Every now and again, they become green. And when a person becomes red, they do something you don't like. That means that the conditions are such that now this person has become like this. And it is just as stupid to become angry with that person as it is to become angry with a red traffic light. Now that is a powerful thought, a very, very powerful thought. And it's very hard to understand. But of course, the core teaching which lies behind this understanding is a sense of non-self. There's nobody there who decides to do something bad, who decides to do something stupid. Just a bunch of cause and conditions that come together. And every now and again, those cause and conditions do things which you don't like. Every now and again, they do things that you do like. And that is all there to it. So remember that. Remember, you cannot change anybody. You cannot change the world. It's hard enough to change yourself. Those of you who have tried to change yourself, you know how difficult that is. Let alone changing other people. Just allow them to be. You can't change them. There's no grounds, no reasons to ever get upset. So that is the first technique I would recommend you to use. And the second one which I would recommend is to take out the personal issues between relationships, between people. Very often the reason why we get upset with somebody is because we feel it is personal. We feel that this person is doing something to upset me. They are talking to me in the wrong way. They're not being sensitive towards me. And because there is a sense of a personal thing there, personal issues between two people, that is very often why we get upset. Now, again, you have to remember the Buddha's teachings of non-self, that things are never, ever personal. Again, one of those foundational things. Remind yourself of that. It's never, ever personal. If somebody does something, even if it appears to be towards you because you are there, it isn't because of you. The reason why they do it is because of cause and conditions within themselves and also outside of themselves coming together, and that's why they act like that at that time. There's absolutely no other reason at all. So once you think like that, once you start realizing that actually there's nothing personal here, there's nothing between me and this person, it's just cause and conditions coming together, there's nothing there, again, it takes away a lot of the sting of how other people behave towards you or behave in generally at all. It's never personal. It's a powerful reflection which I use myself in daily life, because so often we are caught up in this idea that other people are bad towards us. And that is what is one of the worst and most difficult things to deal with. So try those things and see how that helps you on this retreat. And it's important to use these things in a wise way. And then gradually, slowly, you find yourself having this beautiful retreat. Nice, peaceful, easy, no conflict, harmony. And the joy comes up, and the meditation starts to take off, and wow, you're going to come back next year for more. Okay. So, before I end this introductory talk, I always like to read some of the suttas, and I'm going to read a sutta which I also read to the other group, the other meditation group that were here, finished last week with a retreat. I'm one of those people who always likes to go back to the word of the Buddha, because behind everything else, the Buddha is the teacher of anybody who is a Buddhist. If you want to find out what Buddhism is, you have ultimately to go to the word of the Buddha. If you want to find out whether what I teach makes any sense, if you want to find out whether even what Adam Brahm teaches makes any sense, it's always good to check with the sutras. And if it doesn't match with what the Buddha said, then you have grounds for asking questions and what's actually going on. So this sutta is called Removing Resentment. And it goes as follows. And again, this is again about how to overcome anger, overcome ill will, overcome fault finding and a negative mind, so you can have a much more smooth experience on this retreat. So this sutta goes as follows. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friends, bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by means of which a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, lay follower, male or female, are all included in this, by which all of these should entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen. What five? Dear friends, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains openness of mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain openness of mind, placidity of mind from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains openness of mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So this is like a summary of the five types of person that the sutta talks about, and you will see that everybody is included within these five categories, because it moves from the person who is completely impure in all respects to the person who is pure in almost all respects. So everybody is included here. And this is the great thing with a good teaching like this, is that it can always be applied. It's always useful. So the first type of person then. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards a person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose, friends, a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, and tear off the intact section and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. And I'm sure you can see here, this is like one of those principles that we use in Buddhism all the time, is to focus on the good qualities in somebody. And even though he talks here about verbal behavior and bodily behavior, I think that is the reason why he does that, is because in Buddhism we tend to divide things up into body, verbal and mind. So I think that's the reason why he does that here. But I think you can extend that to say that wherever you see something beautiful in somebody, that is where you should place your focus if anger or resentment arises toward that person. It can be very difficult, but with training you can do that. And the thing you can do on a retreat like this is to remind yourself that everybody here comes with beautiful intentions, with good intentions. And that is enough. Place your focus on that intention. Place your focus on the fact that everybody here wants to do something good in the world. The intention is there. And that is one way of removing any negativity that may arise. The second type of person here, Next, friends, how should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose, friends, there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, with both hands he would sweep away the algae and water plants, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here you can see, you sweep away the algae and the water plants, you sweep away the negative things you see, you push them to one side, and you focus instead on the good qualities in that person. How, friends, this is the third person now, how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains openness of mind, placidity of mind? Suppose, friends, there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours and suck it up like a cow, and then depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and then departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains openness of mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the openness of mind, the placidity of mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here you have somebody who is obviously not such a good person. He has a bad bodily behavior, bad verbal behavior, but he gains what he says here, openness of mind, placidity of mind. That is basically means that occasionally he becomes peaceful, he's able to abandon the defilements. And openness of mind is the opposite here of hindrances in the mind. It's a mind which is pure, free of hindrances. Placidity of mind means a peaceful, calm mental state. So even though this person is a little bit of a scallywag, they at least occasionally get a peaceful mind state. So just focus on that, the fact that they have this one little character trait which is still beautiful. Of course, it is difficult to focus on a very small good aspect in somebody. And that's why you have to be very, very careful when focusing on this. It's just like it says here, it's just like you have to get down on all fours and carefully suck up the water from the puddle. In the same way, you have to narrowly focus on that little good thing, little good aspect in that person. Not look at anything else, just focus on that. Focus on that aspect, and then if you can do that, and it's not always easy, and you have to practice again and again to be able to do this, but when you're able to do this, it's a very powerful technique to overcome negativity. And with all of these techniques, remember that it sounds easy on paper, it sounds like, I just focus on the good qualities, all anger, negativity disappears, but in reality, it takes practice to do these kind of things. So these are the things that you have to do them again and again and again, particularly maybe with people who you find are difficult. Again and again, focus on those good qualities. Again and again, build up that perception inside of yourself. When you go into the forest and maybe you do a little bit of walking meditation somewhere, take that time to remind yourself of those good qualities. And then when you build up that as a power inside of your mind, then it is much easier to focus on that afterwards. Everything in Buddhism is about practice, again and again and again, to change your mind state, change your habits. It is not something that's going to happen by itself. It takes effort and it takes hard work sometimes. So that is a person who sometimes gets beautiful mind states, but otherwise is not so good. And then comes the even worse kind of person. Next, friends, how should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain openness of mind, facility of mind from time to time? Suppose, friends, a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district, in other words, somebody who could help him. Another man traveling along the same highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter misery and calamity right here." Misery and calamity, death, basically, right here. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time openness of mind, facility of mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one, or may this good person, abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, this venerable one will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, or even in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed." And this, of course, is one of those standard teachings that you hear in Buddhism all the time, is that when you meet somebody who doesn't have many good qualities, somebody who does all kind of wrong things, sometimes you can't teach them anything because they won't listen, sometimes they're not interested in what you have to say, even if you know the truth and you know what is right, all you can really do sometimes is you have to have compassion for them and say, "This person is going to suffer in the future as a consequence of their actions." And this is like the last resort when you can't see anything good in somebody, and there's nothing there which really is praiseworthy. And sometimes that may be the case, that you see somebody like that, then at the very least, you can have compassion for them, because you know that all they are doing is creating suffering for themselves. They may create a little bit of suffering for the world around them, but they're creating much, much more suffering for themselves. So again, that's a beautiful way of turning around ill will and anger and turning it towards a beautiful state instead, a state of compassion. And then we have the last person here. Next, friends, how should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure and who from time to time gains openness of mind, placidity of mind? So this is like the good person who basically has got his act together. Suppose, friends, there is a pond with clear water, with sweet, cool, clean water, with smooth banks, delightful, shaded by various kind of trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then, after coming out, he would sit or lie down right there in the shade of a tree. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains openness of mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion, one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, to his openness of mind and placidity of mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So here you have the type of person who is easy to remove resentment towards because they are a beautiful person with beautiful character traits, moral in body, moral in speech, and even get good states of samadhi when they practice meditation. And of course that is the kind of person that we use for our loving kindness practice because they're easy to have beautiful thoughts towards. But of course the interesting thing here, which this sutta says, is that even towards these people, sometimes we get upset and angry. And the reason for that is not because there's something wrong with this person. Sometimes we get upset with arahants in this world. People would get upset with the Buddha when the Buddha was around. It's not because the Buddha was bad or did bad things, but it's because of our own defilements, our own mind, because we may not understand fully why the Buddha, why the arahant, why this pure-hearted person is doing things the way they're doing it. So even towards such people, we have to sometimes remove resentment. But basically, this is the type of person that does inspire confidence, that does inspire a sense of joy in the heart when you see these kind of people. And that is why we have things like recollection of the Buddha, the beautiful qualities of the Buddha, recollection of the Arya Sangha, the Aryans out there, the people with pure hearts, the people who are practicing the right way. Because these recollections are done towards people who have beautiful qualities. And it's easy to gain a sense of inspiration when you think about these people. And that is what this sutta is saying here. These are the people we should think about. And that is why the recollection of the Sangha, meaning the Arya Sangha, is one of those meditation objects that the Buddha often recommended. These, friends, are the five ways of removing resentment by means of which the bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, lay follower, can entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen. Okay, so that is a little sutta for you on how to deal with these kind of problems. And I think I'm not going to say anything more at this point. I think I've probably said enough. But if anybody wishes to ask any questions or bring up anything, I know it's the first night, but if you still have something you want to bring up, I'll give you the opportunity now. Any questions anybody has? Anything you'd like to ask about? Anything we've not clear? Okay, well, good. I thought that might be the case. But tomorrow morning, as Abraham will be here, about 8 a.m. is going to be the first talk, I think. And then take things from there. And if anything I've said does not agree with what Ajahn Brahm said, you probably must better off following what Ajahn Brahm says. Okay, so let's pay our homage to the Triple Gem.